Today I'm at Friendly Haven Rise Farm in Battleground, Washington. And I think this is my fourth visit here. I think the first time I was here was 3.5 years ago, and Sepp Holter was in the area. And this farm said that they had like 2 rooms or something like that people could rent for the event. And so I rented it, and then I ended up staying an extra night because I just enjoyed being here so much. And now I've come back. Every time I come here, I learn a lot. And I kind of feel like most of the farms I go to, I feel I don't learn anything. So I crave a farm like this to come and add some things to my, I guess, my arrogant knowledge set. And so today was, I mean, we got here yesterday. This is the first day of the big tour. And, wow, there's just been so much to drink in. And it's been, once again, and just nothing else. It just feels good to be here because it just feels not only am I sure that the food here that I can find is far superior to any crappy organic food that I can find anywhere, but on top of that, there is kind of like something in the soil, something, and it just feels good to be here, and I cannot explain it. And I could probably wax on about a half an hour in that space, but I'm here with Joseph and Jacqueline Freeman, who Jacqueline has been in, I think, 3 of my videos, but probably the video that I still consider to be probably the most important video I've ever made, and that is the colony collapse disorder video, because not only does it explain how colony collapse disorder is a non-issue, it's a red herring, but if you could look at the video in an opposite direction of, like, here's a great way to care for bees. And I know I've talked about Jacqueline in a previous podcast where we were talking about how to respect bees and how we've witnessed people who respect bees and do a very good job of raising bees. But Jacqueline is the only beekeeper I've ever met, the only beekeeper I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot of beekeepers, who I believe has reverence for the bees. And I say this mostly because of the first one time, probably my third visit here, maybe my second visit here, you were teaching a bee class, and you hate to take the lid off of the hives, but you felt for a bee class it was important to see inside and look. And so you did that, and I remember it took like about 7 or 8 minutes afterwards for you to get the lid back on because you would not put the lid back on if there was even the slightest chance that a single bee could be harmed. Whereas in the past, it's like, yeah, every time you put the lid on, you always kill a few bees. Yeah, they'll make more. And so, but this is like, no, wait, little bee, no, little bee, come on, just a little over this side, just a little. And then another one pops up on the other way, no, little bee, I want to put the lid on, little bee.
I want these feathers to move them, to
is
just
it,
get them out of
oh,
the way.
Is it feathers?
It take me quite the 6-7 minutes, more like 2 or 3, but still 2 or 3.
It was. I think you had like the super gentle brushy thing. It was like fluffy brush, and you were trying to like.
I use turkey feathers because we have turkeys here.
Because I know you're worried that the brush might be a little much for the bee.
It's too abrasive, and I want, you know, a feather is such a gentle thing to move them with. They don't mind one bit, and it's natural. It's a bird feather.
Okay.
Seem to have a little bit of like, hey, it's like us.
So we want to do 2 podcasts. This first podcast, we're going to talk about everything but bees. At least we're going to try. We're going to try to leave the bees out. It does seem like bees are your number one thing, but I mean, like, all these other things are a close second, third, and fourth. It's like just a little ahead of all the other things. But I mean, as I look around and I observe all the other things that you're doing here, then it does seem like, I see a lot of reverence for all life. And you know what? I kind of feel like that's part of it. Like, I feel like, and I know this sounds crazy and woo-woo, but I just feel like the plants that are here like being here. And the other animals, even the wild animals that are here, like being here. It's just a place where life is abundant and revered, and it's like life, all forms of life, like being here, except maybe the slugs.
And even the slugs, we tell them, we, you know, there's a place for slugs too. You know, they're at the end of the season, slugs totally, like, go slugs, go eat the stuff that's done. You know, I'm fine with those, and I have an arrangement with them. It sounds funny how I speak of it, but I have an arrangement with them. No slugs in the garden while the garden's active, but you can be anywhere else here. So, and I think that's one of the ways you deal with nature, too, is that you can't just say, you know, oh, I hate slugs, because nature's going to win in the end. So I just have a way of, you know, oh, you can't be here, but you can be over there. So I don't have a, you know, I need to kill them all. And in the garden, I set up the snake habitat, you know, so that the snakes also help keep them down.
One of the videos we have.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And that's one of the deterrents to the slugs being in the garden, too, is that, you know, the snakes hang out over here. You may not want to come in here. The slugs kind of catch on after a while. And I have very little slug problem in the garden because of that. And we get, hey, it's the Pacific Northwest, we get some monster big slugs here.
When we first moved the chickens up into the upper pasture, there were hundreds of them up there, hundreds of slugs.
Yeah, the chickens have done a good job keeping them down in the outside part there. But we have plenty of places for slugs, no doubt.
So now, one thing, there's several things here that are different from most of the farms and gardens that I visit. But one of them is I see lots of piles of rocks and blocks of wood and piles of this and that and piles of brush. Yeah, piles. And I keep thinking to myself, well, yeah, that is your habitat for, like, all sorts of creatures, but including the ones that really find slugs to be delicious.
Yes. Snakes are the primary one. Lizards are the primaries. Were you thinking of?
I'm thinking like beetles that enjoy slug eggs.
Uh-huh.
And
we even have places, like I got a big sisal rug from Goodwill. You know, it's just a natural fiber rug, you know. Cost me a few bucks, and it's like 8x10, and I laid it down on a peripheral part of the garden just outside of it, and I just leave it there. Now, you know, slugs want to go underneath where it's dark and damp and cool and moist, and, you know, that's a perfect location for them. So they go underneath there, but so do my snakes. And when I peel up the corner of the rug to take a look, I'll always see little slug eggs underneath there, and then I see just 3 feet away, I'll see a coiled-up snake sleeping. I think, breakfast buffet.
And now we've seen lots of snakes. We've seen, on this visit, we've even seen a few. And I videoed a few when I was here last time. But all the snakes here are non-poisonous, right?
Right.
Right, okay.
Yeah, well, it's the Pacific Northwest, so, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, as much as the snakes just give me the willies in a serious way, but at the same time, it's always a comfort to know that none of them are too terribly scary.
Yeah, and so. We've got, mostly here, we've got garter snakes and a few rubber boas, which are actually the Pacific Northwest version of a boa constrictor, but they're smaller and gentler, kinder and gentler.
Now, all right, we've got a list of stuff to talk about, but I think we should start at the beginning. So you were telling me yesterday that before buying this particular place, that you had visited more than a few other places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably we looked at well over 200, maybe 250 different farms, and we had a big list with 68 things on it that we wanted to have in our farm. And actually, let me say, we were looking at farms, but we didn't plan on being farmers. We just wanted to have, you know, we both grew up in the country, so we wanted to have a big piece of land, and I don't even think we knew what we were going to do with it.
I think we wanted privacy from our neighbors and outbuildings to build shops in and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So you build the shops in the shop.
Yeah,
a standing building that we could make over into art studios, you know, wood shops, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it was funny because we did want to be secluded from the neighbors, but now that we live in this, we actually live in a smaller portion, an unincorporated area within Battleground in the city. Well, it's not even a city.
Outside
it's a town.
Of the city.
Yeah, we're outside of the city. And we live in Ventersburg, which is a little village that only has, we have 862 houses in this whole village.
Small.
So
spread out.
We have we have great neighbors. So now we like our neighbors. We don't, you know, we're not as, when we didn't know our neighbors, thinking in the abstract of where we'd like to live, we wanted privacy. Now we visit our neighbors. They visit us.
The only neighbor who can see our house lives across the street, and this is the house his mother grew up in. So when he built his, he put all opaque windows on this side, side that faces our house. So he doesn't see us anyway. So.
Yeah, we ended up with the privacy after all. But what you were pointing out, Paul, was that when we actually found one house that had everything on our list, and we said we should love this place, but it didn't have that quality, that something. I don't know what it was. We couldn't put our finger on it.
Je ne sais quoi.
And then we found
happy sauce.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
Then we found this place, and we didn't know anything about it at all, but we had the feeling when we stepped out of the car by ourselves without an agent and, you know, just walked up in the field, and I started crying. It was like we hadn't even set foot in the house. We didn't know where the perimeters were. We didn't know what the outbuildings were here. We didn't know anything about the place, but the feeling was right, and that was the most important thing. And we made the decision to buy this place.
Yeah, before we looked inside the house.
Yeah, it was, this is it, we're home. Joseph, he just looked at me and said, this is the place, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's funny. And it's like when you meet the woman you're going to marry, the man you're going to, you know, you meet the love of your life or something. It was like that with this land. This land, it was like it came right up through us like our legs were roots. And just really, I mean, really, like it went straight to my heart. And we've had that kind of relationship with the land ever since. I didn't know land could do that.
We weren't farmers back then. We didn't even know enough to check out the soil.
which, by the way, in retrospect, if you're looking for land and you know nothing about farming like we didn't know anything, check the soil first and see, is it really good soil for growing things?
And check the water.
Yeah, we didn't know the practical decisions. And we've done a lot of fixing up with our soil, just making it better, 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 which you can do, but, boy, it sure would have been a lot easier if we'd come into land that had great soil to start.
So now I kind of feel like not only is there something like that about the land that a cranky bastard like me can somehow sense, so I'm sure everybody in the world can, but on top of that, on my very first day here, you're like, oh, okay, so I'm walking in and I'm feeling this, and the house is beautiful, the inside is beautiful, and it's kind of like everything is like so, it's like the style of art is something that I like, which I feel like I don't care for most art. But the great part was, the best part was, is when you said, you might not want to stay in this room because we keep it kind of cool. Because of the ladybugs. And this was in February. And it's like, there's no ladybugs this time of year. And it's like, maybe you want to stay in this room over here. This one's heated to a normal temperature, and you'll probably be most comfortable here. Now, I want you to tell me about this ladybug room.
Well, ladybugs migrate. Who knew that ladybugs migrate? And they migrate, and they come to our house. We're one of the places on the stop. And they go to the northwest corner of our house in the upstairs. That's a bedroom. And they crawl underneath, I don't know, shingles, however they get in from the outside. And they sleep they hibernate for the winter in the walls on the northwest corner. So if you turn the heat on in that room, what happens is in the middle of winter, they all wake up like it's springtime. So we keep the heat turned off in there. And, yeah, if anybody visits us in the winter, we say you have to be happy with it being, say, about, you know, 50 in here. And that way they stay in hibernation all winter. And then in the spring, as the sun starts to warm up the walls more, then they all wake up and we open the windows and they all leave.
So now when I was here, I said, you have to tell me more about this ladybug room. And you told me that. And then I said, I have to go in there. And so I go, and you pulled back. You have like this little fabric on the wall. And you pull back the fabric, and there's like 300 ladybugs just right there. And you're saying something like, we think that there's something like 50,000, maybe a couple hundred thousand in the wall. We're not really sure. It's not like we're going to pull the wall out and count them.
Right.
And
tons of them come out in the springtime and fly off and go off and, you know, on their mission.
So my thinking was, this is so cool. This is, I mean, man, these are my peeps. This is, I mean, talk about having a more symbiotic life with nature. So I said, this is the room I want. I have to stay in this room. I have to stay in this room. And I remember that I was only supposed to be there for one night, and then I ended up staying for two. And yeah, and it's like every time coming down this way, I have to come by. But all right.
And then on the stairway, going up to that room in the wall, we have the bees that live in the wall of the house as well. So
I didn't know about that one until today. I didn't know that they were there.
Yeah, next door neighbors. So yes, we.
I got video of that yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So this is there's a chimney on the back of the house there,
yeah,
or something like that.
Little crack at the top where the chimney and the house join together, and this little opening, and the bees, oh, decades ago, you know, wandered in there and set up between the studs. They set up their hive, and I just love that because and they're absolutely wonderful to have in the house because they're hygienically clean. They take care of everything. There's no bugs. There's no mice. There's nothing. They seal off their hive. And in the wintertime when I need my little bee hit, I can just go. I have a stethoscope, and I just put it up to the wall and listen to, and it makes me happy.
And the chimney keeps them warm.
And the chimney keeps them just warm enough to go through winter. Yeah.
So the house here is literally alive. It's like part of the house is thousands of little tiny lives. And for those people that love honeybees, the house is actually part of the wall is made of honeycomb. and then on the other part of the house are the ladybugs.
Don't forget the box elder bugs.
And then in the winter, in the spring, we have a certain time of year, we heat with a wood furnace down in the basement that has these octopus of arms that go up to the different rooms. And we stop in late April. We stop heating the house. So in May, I don't care if it's really, really cold or not, we don't light up the fireplace anymore because the chimney swifts come in and they build their nests on the inside of the chimney all the way down, all along the top part. And we found them because some of them fell down one time. Babies fell out and managed to make their way into our oven, our stove vent somehow. And I opened it up, and three little baby chimney swifts fell out. That was so funny. And we put them on a towel. They're like they have feet like Velcro. Put them on a towel, went up on the chimney, and draped it back down so that their mamas could help them find their way back to their nest. And then we realized they were up there. We said, well, dang, we can't be lighting fires in this thing either. So, yeah, when the chimney swifts arrive in the spring, that's the end of the heat season for us. We just wear more sweaters.
More life all over this place. So you got here. The bees were already here, but when you first moved in, you probably had no idea.
Oh, and can I tell about the bats?
Oh, yes, yes.
Great, yes. So every night in the summertime, we don't have screens on our windows. We don't really have a bug problem. And every night, we have a two-story house with a basement. And the bats come in. We leave the windows open all summer.
Well, tell us first how we found out. We found out. We were sitting in the living room with Jacqueline's mom and a friend. We were watching a video. And it's like the lights were out. There's just a blue flicker from the screen. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw this thing flying around the room. And I said, nobody freak out, but there's a bat flying around the living room.
And my mother went, oh, my hair. I said, no, Maya, you're okay. The bat's not interested in hair.
Our house guest got up, and he went to the front door, and he opened the door, and suddenly there were two bats flying.
So what we realized out of that was every night, about 10-ish or so, the bats come in the upstairs window up in my studio. They come in, and they cruise the room, and they eat any bugs that are in there. If there's any mosquitoes, they're gone.
No screens on the windows.
Yeah, and then they go into each room, and they do their little swoops, and then they come down the stairs into the living room. They do that. They do the parlor. They do the kitchen. They go back to the mudroom, and then they go down the stairs into the basement, and they do all of that. So it takes them, probably 10 minutes to do the whole house, and then you see them come swooping back up through the living room, up the stairs, and out the window. And off they go. So that's how we handle bugs.
Oh, a Okay, that's the first I've heard of that one. Now, I've been here in the evenings. I haven't seen the bat.
Well, we don't usually watch a video when you're here.
Oh, the video brings out the bat?
It's more that we notice them. But if we were sitting in the living room, sometimes you'll see them come through. Sometimes they come through late in the middle of the night.
They live on the west wall of the cottage. That's where they live. You can, if you go down there at dusk, you'll see them all fly out from a certain corner in the west wall of the cottage.
Yeah, we encourage the bats. I love bats. They're wonderful.
You sit there. Last time I counted 8.
So now I wanna talk about, so chronologically, you've now moved in, and you're not farmers, you're not gardeners, but you kind of think to yourself, you know what? Let's, for some reason, for some unknown bizarre reason, hey, you know what might be a good thing is a garden.
Yeah, and we had had gardens in the places we'd lived before. We lived briefly, 2 years in Seattle. And just, we weren't city people. We could tell. We were a little too neighborly for being city people. We kept baking pies for everybody, and they didn't know what we were doing. Hi, I'm your next-door neighbor. Here's a pie. What? How much is it? You know, what does it cost? We're not selling a pie. You just moved in. We're your neighbors. We realized we were more suited to country living. So we had had small gardens there, and we started putting we moved in January, and we had we didn't have any, you know, other than the soil that was on the ground, we didn't have anything. So we went and bought, we were making raised beds, and we went and bought some composted soil from the local recycler. And we made, what did we make, 8 or 10 beds? And we started planting things in it. And we, Joseph said, you know, some of these truckloads of it that we're bringing over, they smell kind of funny. And then when we had things sprouting up, our zucchini and our beans, and the peas, they all were coming in really weird. They were all kind of wrinkly and yellow, and, you know, I mean, how do you fail at growing zucchini? We were growing zucchini because it's a no-fail crop. And then we found out, this article in the paper, that there was this, now they found out, a persistent chemical that I guess the golf courses have been using. And we had bought some of the stuff that they had recycled into compost over the year, and normally compost would break it down to, you know, independent individual chemicals, and
No, it doesn't. Compost into UV radiation breaks it down.
Thank you.
So it's clopyrrolate. I talked to you about it, and I asked you about it, and we finally nailed it down. The stuff that your stuff was laced with is clopyrrolate, and I know this because I dealt with it myself back in 2001.
Yeah, and that's right when this was. Yep. So that was when it was, people were finding out that, hey, this doesn't have the what do they call it, a half-life?
Right. And so then basically when these companies are approached by people who are like, oh, I don't know if I should buy this. I'm not so sure. Oh, if you spray this stuff, you'll save lots of money because you won't have to spray again for like 5 to 7 years. But then you approach them as, we're from the department of checking out, like, whether you're a lying sack of shit or not. And so, you know, how long does this last? Oh, it lasts only 90 days. It's a half-life of 90 days.
Yeah.
But actually, it turns out that clopyrrolate, so Picloram has a half-life of 7 years, but clopyrrolate has a half-life of 11 years.
Oh, my God.
And so you guys did exactly what I've met. I've met lots of people who've done exactly what I've got a video out about this, and what you did is exactly what the woman in the video did, which is
dug it up and took it to the dump.
There's really not anything else you can do that I can think of.
Sit there for a few years and wait for this god awful chemical to.
It was much harder to dig it up.
Yeah.
Than to put it down.
But we did. We dug it up. We took all those truckloads of it to the dump and paid to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that was a pivotal moment for us. That was our first year here 10 years ago, and that radicalized us about, you know, what in the world is going on? Well, we're trying to grow food for ourselves, you know, and organically, and, you know, and we were marginally into organics at that point. You know, it's got to be better for you if it doesn't have chemicals on it. That was about the extent of our knowledge. But, oh, my God, here we are growing our own food without using chemicals and finding out that it's laced with chemicals.
Right, right.
So
organic is shit, really. I mean, you know, permaculture and biodynamics really the way to go. So he figured it out.
Yeah, we did. We figured out that, you know, we needed to make our own compost. And that was the start of it, was, okay, how do we do that? And we started compost piles, and, you know, and then it was a progression, you know, year to year as our gardens grew, and then we learned about permaculture, and we were like, wow, hey, this is cool. Look at this. We could actually, this, like, it's almost a systematic way to learn. You don't have to know everything at once. You can learn what little we needed to know first year and expand out to second year and, you know, learn about all the different aspects of it. That was wonderful. And then from permaculture, we moved over into biodynamics and started learning, you know, we knew we needed more manure.
That's interesting. For me, it was the other way around. We did the gardening, and that was, permaculture wasn't on the radar for me. And then you started doing biodynamics when we hunted, we put the word out to some of our friends that might have access, that we were looking for a cow with horns. We knew nothing about cows. And
we needed the cow manure so that we could make really good compost.
You guys had experience, both of you had experience with horses.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And we figured,
yeah,
horses, cows, how different could they be?
Yeah,
oh, my God.
They're big. They eat grass. How different could they be?
Oh, God. We were so wrong. Cows are nothing like a horse.
So a friend of ours found us one within a month, within a couple of days, actually.
But we had her impregnated and delivered here a month later.
We had no pasture fencing. We had nothing. We built a little paddock first, 30 feet by 60 feet, and then we put one pasture together, the pasture we were up in today. And that took us another month and a half, and then we moved her down here.
By that time, the bull in the field had gotten her pregnant,
yeah.
So we had our milk cow,
mm-hmm.
And she's going to come in fully prepared to. How many pounds a day does a cow make in manure?
11 tons a year. I don't know how many.
Yeah.
You can do the math.
Yeah, we figured we'd have enough for making compost.
Yeah, we have plenty for making compost, but she was not tame at all. And when I told the person who dropped her off that I was planning to have her tamed within 6 months,
Vicky,
yeah. She laughed. Not just a chuckle, it was a belly laugh.
This is our friend Vicky, who has a farm with lots of animals and cows and pigs and all kinds. Yeah, she thought that was pretty hysterical.
But this cow, you know, in the end, she turned out all right. She's a sweetie.
And tell them how you tamed her, because this was not a tameable cow. You couldn't get within 30 feet of her.
Oh, I just sat with her, hung out with her.
You brought a book up in the field. You brought a book up in the field, a thick book, up in the field.
After she had her baby, she...
No, before. We didn't even have a halter on her yet.
Oh.
And he sat down in the field with a book, and he read the book. And a cow has such natural curiosity. But that cow, Joseph, was like a magnet on the hill in the field sitting there, because she'd graze her way over. Now, not because Joseph was there, of course, because it was just because the grass was better over where Joseph was. That was so funny. And she'd be just 5 feet away, grazing away, as long as you didn't look at her.
Yeah. Well, after she did have her baby, I remember the first few times we milked her, we had to... bribe her to get her head through the stanchion. We built a stanchion. We didn't even think she was pregnant, actually, because she was very thin back then. And one day, one of our interns said, I walked by there and I noticed she had a full bag of milk. I'd never seen her udder full. And I said, how many days has that been full? And he said, 3. I was like, oh. She's ready to drop the baby right then, the next couple of days. So we kept a watch on her, and the next day she had the baby. We watched her. I watched her for, I don't know, 12 hours that day?
Yeah.
And she must have been standing with her legs crossed, because I went down to get a sandwich around 2:30, went back up at 3, and the baby was right there. She was waiting for me to leave. So.
Dude, you're cramping her style.
I was.
You know, it was funny. This was January, and he had gone out at night and stayed with her through the entire evening. It was freezing cold, and, you know, just so dedicated. He's going to be there to help if, whatever that meant, to help if needed. And
just wanted me to go away.
Go away. You were out there like 22 hours,
yeah.
Right, as I remember it. Yep, she was just go away, I'll have the baby, and then come back. And the first few times we milked her, she shivered. She was so terrified.
Yeah, she shuddered.
Yeah. But.
Now, you also told me a story that when you were trying to, like, get her close, that you were making a lot of progress with this reading out in the field.
Oh, yeah.
And things were going real good. And it seemed like, you know what, after 6 months of trying, I expect that sometime in the next 2 months, we might actually be able to get a halter on this cow. And then somebody came by who was a cow expert,
a cowboy.
Yeah,
Joseph, we had a friend who, or a guy we knew who said, I'm a cowboy. I grew up on 10,000 cows. I can just put the halter on this afternoon. And we had been doing it like little by little, you know, I would bring the halter over and, you know, we were up to the part where we could pet her head. We could rub underneath her chin and I could put the nose of the halter up to her nose. I couldn't get the top over yet. So we were pretty close. But we weren't up to it yet.
Sure is great that an expert could come by and save you some time, and
yeah,
you could learn from the expert.
Yeah.
That's great learning from experts.
He got his rope and just threw it over the top of her horns, completely freaked her out. She went right over the top of the fence. I did not know a cow could jump that high, and went out and stood like 200 feet away in the field looking at us like, what the hell was that? And we had to start over at square one.
Well, we did start over at square one, but we didn't actually get the halter on until we got the stanchion built. So we kind of, in a way, we did sort of the same thing. We got her to stick her head in the stanchion, and then from a distance, we had a rope attached to it. We pulled it and locked her in, and then we put the halter on her.
Yeah. And then
she still freaked out, but she was fine after that.
But that was such a good learning part for us, because that really did take us, you know, 8 months. To get to the part where we were really, you know, we didn't raise her from a baby calf. Get her from being a freaked out feral cow in a field who wouldn't let anybody come near her. And she was terrified. If Joseph ever raised his hand, I think she'd been hit by a guy before. Because cows have a memory like an elephant. You know, and he would just raise his hand like he was going to just put his hand through his hair or something. And she'd, you know, freak out and run off. So we had to be really tender with her. And I think we both learned a whole lot about, you know, the virtue of patience with an animal. You just can't rush that
animal.
The trust thing took months to develop. She had come from a tremendously untrusting place to being, she's a really sweet cow now.
Right, I saw you out there today, and like, you know, either of you go out there, and she just comes and just, you know.
She's let me rub her all
she
over.
She still won't let me catch her. She'll let Jacqueline catch her any time, any day, but not me.
But she's right up next to you. It's just she doesn't like to be held.
Yeah.
Where she lets me touch her all over, and I can walk up to her any time. And you know, she's just more my cow. You, on the other hand, have the relationship with the goats.
I'm just the one that feeds her all the time.
Feeds her, cleans up the manure, and, you know, keeps her pasture nice. Other than that, she likes me best. But you've got the relationship with a lot of the other animals. It's the primary relationship with them. They see you as the one they're most focused on. I think one of the things is really we've gotten a great education from our farm animals in how to be with animals. And Joseph's really, he's the center of that with the animals. He has a way of being with them that's really calm. I see a lot of people with their animals, especially new people with animals, they just don't understand how the animal thinks. And Temple Grandin's got some wonderful books about looking at the world like through cow eyes, you know, and what is it like? You know, a tarp blowing in the breeze, you know, way over there is something to be really freaked out about. And
rule number one, never look up. Just don't. Cows, they got like a religion about don't ever look up. It's like their number one rule. Cows cannot look up. Have you ever noticed that? Like,
yeah,
they can't do it. I know that as a kid, I worked on a cattle ranch, and we put like the calves, we put them on this table thing. They go in, they get kind of squeezed on the sides, and then the whole wall moves, and then they're on their side.
Mm-hmm.
But the eye that is now pointed up at the sky twists, and it looks to the ground. Cows cannot look up. And it's the most bizarre thing. Now, in hindsight, it's like that they called it a calf table, this contraption. And in hindsight, I think that may have been a bit disrespectful to the animal. and I don't recommend it. But I've seen it many times, like a cow's in stress and on its side, and still the eye that's pointing at the sky cannot look up. Like they'd rather, like the eye has to twist out of its socket before it looks up.
You know, it's funny when with chickens, so many people I know, they get chickens and they're in the country and they don't want to have a rooster because the rooster is going to crow in the morning and wake them up. And, you know, I tell them, no, you kind of got to have a rooster because a chicken.
You need to get your ass out of bed.
Yeah. But for the function of chicken
put
community.
Put it far enough away from your bed.
Yeah, just don't put it outside your bedroom window. The chicken, the hens, their job is to look down all the time. They're looking, they're foragers. You know, they're looking for seed, bug, you know,
they
bug, whatever.
They have to eat enough food to produce an egg every single day.
Yeah, so they're pointing down with their little tush pointing up, their little tail feathers pointing up. And if you look at them, the rooster spends his whole day looking up. That's his job. He's looking up, he's looking around. He's looking up, he's looking around. So we've had times where, I remember I was up in the garden once and we had the chickens all free ranging and they were just wandering around all over the place. And I heard this little chirp that the rooster makes. And I looked up and sure enough, there was a hawk just really far away, like just coming over the horizon. And he had given his warning signal. And I looked down. Now, how long does it take me to, like, hear the chirp, look up, look down? I looked down, and there's no chicken in sight.
Yeah, you can't see any of them.
Just been there. And they all either ran for the bush or they go flat to the ground. They look like someone stepped on them. They just go, like, they look like nothing, a piece of litter or something. And that's the rooster's job. He's the one who guards all the time, and it tells everybody, it's safe to be out, come over here, I found some food, or danger, danger, go make, you know, go hide.
So now, I think it's going to depend a bit on the rooster. I remember for a while I raised some white rock roosters, and they were like the most unfriendly critter I think I've ever had. All of them, every white rock rooster. And we had too many of them is when there would be like six white rock roosters that would wait at the coop, and when the hens would go in, the hens would like stay out as long as they could, but eventually they got to go into roost, and then like all the roosters would have a go at every hen.
Too many roosters.
Yeah. But on and then
well,
to
get that kind of stuff.
And
on.
Right.
Rooster pecking order. You know, whoever gets the hen last is the top rooster.
Well, no, what happens is the top rooster, he's got the harem that follows him around foraging and stuff like that, and the others are on the out. Maybe there's a second one who's got a smaller harem of his hen, but the rest of them are just on the out. They're like, they want hens, they don't have hens because they're not big enough to keep them, so they have to grab them when they go by. And they hang out in places where the hens do go by, and they rape them, basically.
Yeah.
And it creates massive stress. We had six roosters one time, and four of them were in this category. And it got so bad that some of the hens didn't want to leave the coop, and that's when we got rid of them.
Right. I was thinking of it like hen rape, too.
We'll limit the number now.
So
your egg production goes down, your hens get stressed out, and it's just not worth it.
So I was kind of thinking, like, I need to put them in the freezer. I need to get them into the freezer right away, and maybe in the next couple of days. It was the next day I'm out there.
The problem also is if you leave them like that, and then you want to replace your good roosters later on, those aren't good candidates because those behaviors persist, and they don't treat the hens right later on. We had one kill a hen later on because he abused it too much.
So the next day, these roosters decided, I had some stick in my hand for something, and the roosters one at a time would come, and they decided that they were going to take me down. They just attacked. They just, one at a time. Yeah, I'm a giant by people standards. And so I just took the stick and just whacked them, and they broke their neck instantly. And then the next one came up and thought it would attack me. You know, that one was a wimp, but I'm bigger. I'll take you down. And whack. And that's like I took out four roosters. Just, it's like, well, I wasn't going to butcher them today, but it turns out I am. And so there was that. But the other thing is that later I had Buff Orpington roosters.
Oh, yeah.
So Man, total opposite.
Yeah.
Complete gentleman.
They're some of my favorites.
And so then they go out and you see this over and over again. They're like you're saying, a little harem. Mm-hmm. And then if they're wandering away from the harem and they spot like a little bit of food, they make a certain sound. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then
see what I found.
And then they stand next to the food and the hens eat the food.
Yeah.
And then they're like looking for the next bit of food.
Yeah.
So
taking care of their little harem.
Right. But I agree. If you've got a rooster with, you know, bad manners, that's a soup rooster.
Yeah, we have two kinds of roosters on our farm. We have the friendly ones, and then we have the ones that are in the freezer.
What is the place for mean roosters? I mean, I know a guy who lives in a place that has a lot of coyotes, and he keeps the biggest, baddest rooster he can find. Because the first rooster we had, he was a gentleman with the hens, but he actually attacked a dog that grabbed one time, a dog that came on the property.
A stray dog that grabbed one of his hens, and he went after, and this was a dog that was like the size of a lab.
You want one that's a little of both.
Okay, but I like that.
Good to people, good to hens.
Yeah.
Bad to predators.
I like that. Yes, I kept livestock guardian dogs on my property, and when people came to my property and they brought a dog, I mean, like, they would just turn them loose and they would, like, go for the chickens and try and kill a chicken.
We don't let people bring
dogs. And then my dog, so that was it. That was my whole thing. I don't allow other people to bring, but it's like they just showed up. They, like, own the planet.
You know,
and I'm but a servant on their planet. And they show up, they let their dog out, and then my dog will then attack their dog and take it down. Hmm. And the guy's like, hey, your dog's attacking my dog. It's supposed to do that. I hope my dog kills your dog. You forgot to ask me if it's okay to let your dog out.
Yeah. And you know,
because if you'd asked me, I'd have said, no, if you let your dog out, I will tell my dogs to kill your dog and eat it so I buy less dog food.
Well, we put a sign at the bottom of the driveway that says no animals.
Right.
But I think that's something people don't realize.
Don't pay attention to it.
Yeah, I know. They think, oh, they don't mean my dog. But we've had people bring Yeah, really. We've had people bring their dogs on. And the thing that outside people don't realize when they come to a farm is they think, a farm, my dog can run. First of all, that dog is probably bringing in things that don't already exist here. The only time we've had fleas on our farm have been following the visit of two or three dogs that had fleas. And within 10 days, you know, everybody here, and that's a big problem to go through and get rid of the fleas. And it just, you know, oh, man. It's
doable, though. We free-range chickens for a week or two, and they eat them all.
We had people bring their extremely well-trained dogs who would never catch a chicken on the farm back when we were young and dumb. And, yeah, and just go off and grab a chicken.
It's not their chicken. The dogs don't see it as their chicken. Our dog sees them as when we first got him, he went after the chickens and the cats, but we taught him not to, and now he doesn't. Now you can it's actually funny to see him in the turkey pen because they'll follow him around, and one of them will peck at his tail, and he doesn't do anything, which is great.
He purposely looks away, he ignores, he will not, you know, it's like, no, I can't look there. And he's really, really well trained. We know if he looks at the cats and or any of the chickens and he's got that predator stare that a dog can get, we just say, you know, my turkeys, my cats, you know, my birds.
Yeah.
That's a good livestock guardian dog. I mean, they really understand this is our family. This is my herd. This is my pack. These are my peeps.
Yep, these are the ones you take care of.
But other people's dogs don't have that sense. They see a chicken and it looks like a snack.
Yeah.
So they're going to go for it.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's a thing of respect. Yeah. If you have a farm and you're going to visit somebody at a farm, don't bring your animals with you.
Right.
We tell people we've already got enough animals here.
Just when Paris Hilton comes, leave that little fucking rat in your in your purse at home. You know, so, don't even bring them. It just doesn't make, because and I think a good farm dog is going to see somebody that's not part of the family. And a good farm dog knows people are, you know, in fact, I remember my dogs would wait until they, like, got some kind of idea for me, whether friend or foe, you know? And it's like, I'm not sure about these people. I can kill them if you want, but I'm not sure. I mean, sometimes you're weird about people, like you're okay with them, but I'm telling you, I don't trust them.
And, you know, to them, a dog, a coyote, what's the difference? You're telling them, you know, don't let the coyote on.
But oh, yeah.
Why would that dog be okay?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Let's be consistent with it. And that's one of the things with your animals. You have to be consistent with it. So,
right.
Yeah, where, like, don't bring your animals here.
Yeah, you don't want to confuse them. They have a clear job to do.
There's a hierarchy of what the jobs are for the other animals here that's already taken up. And then the second thing is introduction. You want your farm to be a closed system. You don't want to introduce disease into it. You know, that's something as simple as, you know, if I wear my farm boots out to some place and somebody's got a sick animal, I'm going to wash my farm boots before I come back over to my farm anyway. And, you know, when you're bringing other animals in quarantine or, you know, that's just common sense.
Well, I like the idea that, and a lot of farms, they don't, I've been to farms where it's like, when you come here, you have to wash the bottoms of your boots with this stuff. But frankly, I like the opposite approach. Like, our farm is so healthy, it's resilient to whatever you might be bringing on here. So you go out to that chicken house where it's, they hose all those animals down with every kind of chemical there is. Because, and then they wear white, those white suits. Have you seen those things? The disease suits with the helmets and the hazmat suits. That's what they're wearing, a full hazmat suit. And it's, and the first time I saw it, I thought, well, it's because it smells so bad in there because they got so many chickens or hogs or whatever. And they got like their own air supply in that suit. But no, it's to protect the animals from whatever might be on them. And it's like that's not farming. That's just wrong. So I think having good polyculture, good diversity, it's like it's resilient to anything. It's like the whole thing with raw milk. Put the listeria into the raw milk. The raw milk kills the listeria. No more listeria. Put the listeria into the pasteurized milk, and the listeria goes, yee-haw, I'm going to reproduce and kill everybody. So it's kind of like I like the idea that a good farm can, it's like bring it. Bring it. We'll take it on. No problem. So, all right, we've wandered on like tangent upon tangent upon tangent. And now, if I remember correctly, one of the points, so on your list of 68, you had a list of 68 things when you're looking for land.
Uh-huh.
And when you came to this, it's kind of like you took your list and you wadded it up and you threw it away after 200 and some odd properties.
Mm-hmm.
You came here, and it's like, I don't care if it meets the list or not. And it turns out there were, like, two things that were not on the list.
One thing.
Is there just one? Okay, I want to hear about that one thing that's not on the list that was on the list, but this land does not have.
We didn't have, we wanted a creek or a pond. And, you know, we've got, like, a little concrete pond here. And we thought, well, okay. Yeah, we wanted running water that ran through the middle of the land. And we didn't have that. There's a creek that, you know, two pieces of land over. There's a creek that runs, it's just at the bottom of the hill here. But it's not on our land. And how many, 500 yards from here, if that?
Something like that.
Anyway, not far, but it's down in the woods. But it's not on our land.
500 feet.
Yeah, 500 feet. So you can tell how close by that is. Anyway, I've learned since then that I am so glad we don't have the creek running through our land because we have very, very few predator problems. And we have a neighbor who lives diagonal from us, and the creek is the north side of her long, narrow strip of land. She raises chickens, heirloom chickens. She does a fine job with it, and all the predators are hanging down at her place. She's got cougar, bobcat, black bear that visits once a week, and coyotes on a regular basis, as well as minks, hawks, owls, and what else has she got? Weasels. And those are all, and they pick a chicken a day off her farm. A chicken a day. And she's really pretty good about, like, she gets them all in at night, and, you know, she actually had one of her owls leaped, she was pointing at one of her chickens that had roosted up in the tree, her young chick. She said, you come down out of there, the boogeyman's going to get you. And she had no sooner gotten the sentence out of her mouth than a great horned owl swooped down and grabbed the chicken. Boop, that was it, gone. And she's on the creek, and so all the animals come down because of the creek and now because of the animals. And they hang out down there because they got, you know, drinks, they got lunch and a beverage. They've got the water there, and that's
the
attraction to them.
The creek is cover.
Yep.
It's like a super highway for critters.
Yeah. So, and what we've got is more open land, and we don't have the creek here. Man, oh man! I mean, what are we? We're like 1,500 feet from her,
yeah.
And she's got daily predator problems.
You lost three
birds
last winter, three chickens to hawks, I believe.
Young chickens.
Yeah.
Yeah, young ones, and that's a bit of a danger. But you know, we don't lose. We have a lot of young chicks every year, and we still. The majority of them make it, but really, I don't think I could count on two hands 10 years worth of animal losses. And she's got a chicken a day. So, anyway, that's something that I'm really glad didn't happen. I'm happy to have that creek way over there, with that forest trail, forest edge on it.
Now she's got a mastiff, which
yeah.
is on a borderline, not your more common, but borderline livestock guardian dog breed.
It's a Tibetan mastiff. They are livestock guardian dogs.
Yeah.
And. But I'm guessing, but she's used as a show dog.
Also.
Well, she's show
and a search and rescue dog. It's a very talented animal.
And in the day and the night, he lives in there with all the chickens. And he does do good protection, but, you know, come on. How are you going to protect from the great horned owl swooping down and grabbing somebody?
She has one dog.
She has a few dogs. He's the main livestock dog.
He's the only livestock dog.
Yeah.
The other one is a companion for her husband, and then she's got a little Schipperke cross that doesn't do much of anything but be cute.
Yeah, that's a role.
Cute. That's cute. Is
the Paris Hilton role.
All right, yeah. Having a hard time buying in on that one, but all right. Anyway, I usually believe that you need to have at least two, preferably three, livestock guardian dogs, because it's like with coyotes. Coyotes will try to draw the dog off in one direction and then come in and take the animals from another direction. But livestock guardian dogs know that trick. And so one will chase the coyotes in one direction and the other one will stay behind. And so, but if you've got three dogs, it's like two of them will go kill the coyotes while one stays behind to protect.
We're in the nice position of, you know, the dog pees everywhere, so you know we've got
right.
that the smell, the scent of dog out there, and that's a really big deterrent. But
we've
I think
only
the primary
one
thing
coyote
is
coyote kill that I know of.
Yeah,
just one.
Yeah. So, but just not even though we've seen all of these animals here on our land or right next to our land, they don't seem to bother our animals, and I like to think that that's part of the intent of the land too, that we try to keep the land.
Yeah.
To say it really a sacredness to the land. I don't know for sure that that's why this works or not, but it is a much more peaceable kingdom than I think the average place is.
So now I want to change the subject. When I was here 3.5 years ago for the very first time, there was a cat here that I liked a lot.
Oh, Daniel.
And I remember this cat was hanging out with me, and I was hanging out with this cat. And apparently this cat, I recall correctly, this cat usually doesn't take a shine to folk. And I was like thinking, oh,
independent sort.
But he kind of seemed to take a shine to me. And I like cranky people. I like you. So me and this cat are hanging out, and then you told me that this cat was like freaky old.
Yeah, he was 17 then. And
yeah.
You couldn't tell. His coat was soft and shiny.
And thick.
Mm-hmm.
And
didn't have any of the sign of an old cat.
And then you told me a story about Daniel, which just, I had some difficulty believing it at first, but then I went and did some experiments on my own and confirmed it. And it's just an amazing story.
Well, when we were here with him at first, I guess that first year, when he was all of 12, he started having some old age problems, and we took him to the regular vet who said, you know, buy this expensive, what was it, kidney food or something, and, you know, maybe we can get him to go another 6 months to a year. And then we took him to our holistic vet who we just found, and he said, go raw food. You can keep this cat going much longer. And we switched over from...
Oh, yeah, he had kidney stones back.
Yeah. We switched over from doing regular cat food, like everybody does. You know, everybody, even the healthy cat foods that are not raw food. You know, we were feeding him the healthy cat foods, but he said, nah, go raw food. So we started feeding him ground up raw chicken, and we didn't have cows quite that early.
Well, when we started it, we bought the raw food varieties they had on sale at the grocery store, and then we started making our own, and then we bought the more generic stuff they ground up at the organic food store around here. And we found out if you make it yourself or you buy it, the price is not that much different, generally speaking. 50 cents a batch, something like that. If you add all the stuff in, you're supposed to add in. So after all,
we fed him a raw food diet. His health improved immensely in a really, in just weeks, you could see the difference in him.
We fed him on top of the fridge because we had two other kittens at the time, and they were starting to steal his food.
And then we went, what the heck? Why are we feeding them the commercial cat food? We know how the end of that story goes.
Yeah.
It ends up like this with cats that are ill. With cats and dogs that get ill way too early in their lifetime.
So from 6 months on, these two cats were raised on raw food, and I've never seen healthier cats. They have wide mouths, real wide jaws. Their fur is thick and shiny, and they're long and athletic.
And they're 1.5 the size of a normal cat.
Yeah, and they'll go catch most of their own food on their own.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Mice,
so,
voles.
So not only you feed them raw, but you feed them less.
Yeah,
a normal cat.
Yeah. We've had times where our cats don't come in for 2 weeks straight for food because they're eating voles. That's their primary diet, voles.
Voles and mice.
Yeah.
So
every now and then again a rat.
Anyway, and Daniel just died this past year. He died at the ripe old age of 20, and he looked right up pretty much to the end. He looked great. You would have said he was a cat half his age. He was really good.
Yeah, I was really surprised. I thought he was probably like, you know, middle-aged cat, like 6 or 7 or something. When you guys told me he was 17, it was kind of like, wow. And, you know, it kind of makes sense. I mean, cats in the wild kill an animal and eat it. They don't exactly throw it on the barbecue first, and let alone go out and harvest grain and then mash it into kitty beans. So whereas a dog is more of a scavenger, kind of an omnivore. A dog will eat just damn near anything.
Oh, yeah, a dog eats broccoli, apple. Apples are falling off the trees right now, and I'll see him walking around chewing on an apple.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, that's what they do. The cats, though, they're meat eaters. But they get a little bit of grain because that vole has eaten some seeds, or the mouse has eaten some seeds, and it's got some herbs, and it's, you know, it's seasoned, it's flavored. So they get the, you know, whatever's in their digestive system comes into them as well. So they get a little bit.
There's only one organ they won't eat.
We don't know what that organ is, but it's always the little teeny one they leave behind that we find at about 2 a.m. when we're barefoot.
The cat caught something, brought it into the house,
ate
everything except for this one organ.
And
you know,
we step on it.
Okay, all right. That's an interesting way to get an education in vole organs, vole anatomy.
Well, the worst is rabbits because there's certain parts of the intestines they won't eat, and those are still full of nasty. And if you step on those, you're tracking it around.
Oh, yeah.
But we were in no shoes house being a farm, so we're pretty quick to find those things.
So yesterday, I think you guys make me look good because I come here and I learn things and then I share things and everybody thinks I'm smart.